was the federal parole and probation officer who currently works in the state of Oregon, that was something that needed to be done based upon the industry standard. I want to make one thing real clear to the committee, is that we as an organization and we as individual parole and probation officers have been getting some bad press that all we want is guns and we want to run around and arrest people. Our complaint with the Accident Prevention Division resulted in citations on a number of violations, and also I believe caused the Department of Corrections to move into an atmosphere where they are ordering radios for our use. They're also exploring the possibility of getting us some body armor. But as you heard testimony today from Elise Clausen, they are not willing or even willing to talk about arming us. Now, what Ms. Clausen testified to today was that the ideas of the Department of Corrections as far as arming goes to a specific threat on a specific officer. Recently, we documented a bona fide contract on a parole officer's life in Coos Bay. The Oregon State Police investigated this contract. A grand jury investigated the contract. It was a bona fide, open-ended contract, and it took the Department of Corrections 16 months to arm this officer. In the meantime, he wandered around out there, totally unarmed and unprotected. This is unacceptable, and it should be unacceptable to the citizens of the state of Oregon. We don't see any possible way, given the job we face today in this environment, of saying that we have to wait until there's a threat in order to arm a parole and probation officer so that they can do their job safely. I heard some comments earlier today about philosophical differences. When you issue a parole officer a badge and a set of handcuffs, and part of their job duties is to go out and arrest offenders, then that is not a philosophical difference. That is a law enforcement role, and we are expected and required to do just that. I suppose at some point you could take away our arrest powers, and then you would have 28,000 convicted criminals running around loose on the streets, and I don't think that would be acceptable to you either. One of the things I'd like to point out in House Bill 2893 is that what we're asking for in House Bill 2893 is the permission to carry a concealed weapon under the same circumstances that the current law allows hunters and fishermen, as long as they possess a hunting and fishing license and going to and from a hunting and fishing expedition. So any person in this room, as long as they have a hunting license, can carry a concealed weapon without a permit. What we're asking is the same courtesy and the same right that these hunters and fishermen have, but we are also insisting that our people be trained and certified by an instructor from the Board of Police Standards and Training. One of the things that I'd like to point out, too, is we talked about the offender profile, and that is that I heard comments from different people that if we have a high caseload or a very dangerous caseload, then those officers should be armed and others should not. The problem we face is not just with the offender and the profile of the armed robber, for example, but if you're currently supervising someone for a driving offense or for a theft in the first degree or a stolen vehicle, they may have a serious violent crime somewhere in their background. And you also must consider the familiars, the aunts, uncles, brothers, and sisters, and their pit bulls that live in the same residence that we are constantly exposed to. I was at the Capitol last Friday, and I saw the hearing room I saw three hearing rooms that was overflowed from the gun bill that was discussed earlier today. And I'd like to point out that one of my probation officers was in the residence where Mr. Purdy resided a week before he went to Stockton and killed those kids. At that time, Mr. Purdy had the AK-47. And my officer could have walked into a situation and he could have died also. And this officer had no radio, no means whatsoever to protect himself. As far as the risk profile that was mentioned earlier about how many officers are assaulted, we have a lot of officers assaulted. The Federation of Parole Officers, in the absence of any kind of a uniform reporting system implemented by the Department of Corrections, we institute our own report, and we've been getting 5 and 6 reports every day about dangerous incidences where weapons have been seized, where knives have been taken off clients. Even in our own offices, they bring the knives into our offices. I recently had a PO kicked in the groin while he was trying to effect an arrest in the office with other POs assisting him. Now, that report would not substantiate a state accident report because there was no permanent injury. But it certainly generated a report to my group, because it was an injury that we needed to document. We've also had a number of incidents of dog bites and attacks by pit bulls and German shepherds that they make it to the state accident insurance fund, but that seems to be where they lay. Comment was made about increased cost and liability to the agency. We checked with the actuarial counsel at the state accident insurance fund, and we were told that until a risk history is developed, there is no additional cost to our agency to arm POs. As far as arming POs, I also want to point out, I heard mention from Representative Bryan about training and psychological profiles. Currently in Oregon, state police officers are not given any psychological background before they're hired. Some local police agencies and sheriff's offices do psychological profiles. I would insist that my people are trained and certified and qualified to carry a firearm as I would anybody who is carrying a firearm in this state. I think that's necessary if you're going to require people to enforce the laws and protect themselves and the public, that they be trained in the use of a firearm and be able to do it well. And hopefully we'll never, ever be put in a situation where it'll have to be used, but that's to be seen. In concert with that, I have had a meeting with our new director, Fred Purse, and I told him that our officers would be willing to undergo the training on their own time. If the department would provide the ammunition and the instructor, that we would take our own time, our vacation time, and we would do the training on our own time so that we could be armed, so there would be less cost to the agency. We also offered to buy our own weapons under certain parameters that the department would set. If they told us what they wanted us to carry, we'd be happy to buy our own. So that would not be a cost to the agency. Further, we're a little different than most police agencies, where if a district car is out of the district, then they usually have to hire somebody to work overtime, or the other district car winds up slipping over boundaries and so forth. So there's an increased cost to the agency while officers are out for training. It's not true in our case. When I go on vacation for 1 day, 2 day to go catch the elusive salmon, my work sets on my desk, and when I come back, it's still there waiting for me, and I do it. So it would be no different if I was down getting firearms training. The work's going to be sitting there, and when I get back, I'm going to go ahead and pick it up 2 days down the road. And if there's an emergency, we have officers who are assigned to take care of the work. So by and large, the increased cost of the agency is very little. Again, I go back to the same thing. The arguments I've heard is philosophical differences, that that's not our job. And heavens, I wish it wasn't. But that's not the way it is. And I urge you to support House Bill 2893. I have a number of officers out there who are very, very, they're scared. They're just downright scared. If you go into the Columbia Villa at 8 o'clock at night, where the Crips and the Bloods are having their gunfights, you would be too. One of the things I might point out, the accident prevention investigator went with one of my officers to an area in Polk County called the Hideout, and there's a pretty bad guy up there. And my PO pointed it out to the accident prevention investigator and kind of scared him a little bit. And about a month later, a civilian car turned around in a driveway across the street and took 3 rounds through the door from a Mini 14. This guy's not under supervision, but that's an area where all the crooks hang out, and they have methamphetamine labs out there. It's getting real scary out there, folks, and I really, you know, I urge you to give real positive consideration. I'm available for questions.
Oh, I was just going to ask, I appreciate the information a lot. I didn't know that the state police do not undergo exam. I think that's fairly routine nowadays. I'm surprised that the state police do not. If by chance that was the way it were to come down, were you saying that you would or would not have an objection to kind of psychological examination that goes on routinely, not aimed at you guys, but routinely for what I consider most sheriff's offices in the city?
Oh, I have no problem at all with that. I think that, you know, I think that would be a safeguard for everybody, the public and us as well. And the training, and I think routine qualification, so that, you know, you have to. The thing about firearms, as you probably know, is we don't want to run into a situation like we did in one of the Option 1 counties where a PO found a handgun and, not knowing how to unload it, stuck it out the window and pulled the trigger six times until it ran dry to empty it. And this is the kind of lack of training that's so significant with the Department of Corrections and with some Option 1 counties, that training is really hurting. And we want that training, and we want the ability to do our job. That's the bottom line. And yes, we would certainly have no problem with the side
blood. That PO officer is now a member of the Bloods, is that right?
I don't know.
Mr. Chairman? When you're ready. How much counseling do you do?
How much counseling do I do? With my clients, I assume.
Not
with my POs.
No, how much counseling to do as part of your 40-hour work week? How much counseling you do with these people that you're supposed to be supervising?
Probably 20%.
How does that differ from what it used to be maybe 10 years ago? I don't know how long you've been.
I've been around 12 years.
Has there been a shift?
Yes, a drastic shift. What we used to do is occasionally we would make an arrest, usually for someone and for very insignificant technical type violations, not going to drug treatment, for example, although that can lead to something really bad. But we would usually be able to intercede before new criminal activity took place. And so we did a lot more counseling then because we had a different profile of offender. Right now we have got so many people that are dangerous and carrying weapons and committing more crimes that our counseling, unfortunately, has gotten down to the point where it's trying to facilitate some kind of action on their behalf to get themselves into a program or get themselves into a job where they're not going to have a lot of free time and deal with problems. Most of our work now, unfortunately, is enforcement-oriented. We do a lot of arrests. We do a lot of searches. And incidentally, one of the things I noted the other day, it used to be back in the old days when a PO would pick up a handgun, seize it during a search or something, everybody in the office was going, "Wow, did you see that? This is really something." And now we pick up 2, 3, 7, 8, 15 automatic weapons, and it's, hey, that's the day's business. Right now, Oregon puts away more armed career criminals under the Armed Career Criminal Act than any state in this country, and that's real scary because those are the same people that we supervise. And those are the same people that a PO will call the ATF and say, "Hey, I got Charlie Smith out here, and he's got 1, 2, 3 crimes, and if we find a weapon on him," and we are the ones that are calling ATF and alerting them that we've got a guy who might fall under the Armed Career Criminal Act. The same guys that we're going out and visiting.
Another question. Do you find with this significant shift in the duties that you're doing that the Department of Corrections is increasingly more paranoid about the liability factors of your involvement with more violent criminals? And is that an issue in terms of arming you? I heard that from Elise Clausen, and I'm concerned about the training that you receive on a formal basis, either from the state, and I'm not sure if you're like the corrections officers who work behind the walls or not, but currently there is no training. And I'm wondering if there's a sense of paranoia by the administrators in the department that, by golly, if we do arm you, we're going to have an increasing amount of confrontations, and therefore we're going to have lawsuits that arise out of it. And do you sense that's a problem or not a problem? Or
I think I would be more inclined to say it falls back on that philosophical difference that they hired us to be social workers or caseworkers or counseling as opposed to being out there, you know, with handcuffs and making arrests. One of the things that the committee needs to know is that for most police departments in this state, the only requirement is a high school diploma and successful graduation from the police academy. With the Department of Corrections right now, 99% of my people have four-year college degrees. We have a number of master's degrees. Our average longevity is over 7 years, and all of us either possess or are eligible to apply for the advanced certificate from the Board of Police Standards and Training. We do not get routine firearms training at the police academy, however. It's a four-week academy, and then we have a field training manual that we work with a coach when we come out of the academy. But we've got a tremendous amount of experience in terms of longevity of our people.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Mannix.
Are you aware that this bill does not require that the administrative agency which employs you allow you to carry firearms?
I'm familiar with that. One of the things...
All this says is that it's not unlawful for you to carry firearms.
That's correct. One of the things that we've been told in past by two different administrators was that they weren't sure that the legislature gave them clear approval that they could arm us. So what this is, I guess you would call it enabling legislation, which takes that argument away, and the fact that I think the I don't know how you can pass.
Let me ask the question this way.
Okay.
What if we amended this bill to make it clear that we're just saying it's not illegal, but it's going to be up to your employers to make that decision? If we said, added the phrase, and the officer is authorized to carry the firearm by the public body which employs the officer, puts it right back into you convincing your supervisors.
Well, the problem we've got with that is that we haven't been able to convince our employer that it's dangerous out there.
Well, see, I'm not real comfortable intervening and making a day-by-day decision by law that an agency has to say in all circumstances you have to carry a firearm, or for that matter, that in no circumstances you may carry a firearm. I'm much more comfortable saying go through the chain of command, let the officer in charge or the supervisor or the administrator make some determination. I'd even be comfortable saying there ought to be some rules that outline when firearms ought to be carried. But I don't like being there overlooking the officer, looking over that officer's shoulder day by day through some law that tells them when they can or cannot. I'd much rather be at the most in the position of saying, well, we're not going to say it's illegal for you to do it, but then you talk to your people within the organization about when it ought to be done or ought not to be done. You see what I'm getting at?
I understand what you're saying. The problem we've got with our management and the Department of Corrections and with the Option 1 counties is that philosophically they're opposed unless there is a significant personal threat on a case-by-case basis. And that doesn't do anything to protect the officers who are routinely going out doing home visits at night, unarmed, without any kind of protection whatsoever. And this is what we're trying to get at.
Well, then isn't this more a Labor Committee matter? We're talking labor management relations in terms of your decision or management's decision.
Well, again, I fall back on the same thing, though, that we've been told by our administrators that there's not clear legislative authority for them to arm us. And what we're trying to do is say, hey, the legislature has now said it's okay as long as we're trained, and now it's going to be between us to determine where and when. And this basically takes that argument and makes it a moot argument.
Yeah, but there's a difference between us saying you can carry a weapon at all times and us saying you can carry a weapon at all times if the agency you work for decides that it's appropriate, or when the agency you work for decides it's appropriate.
I understand what you're saying. The problem I have is right now the Department of Corrections is under citation under the Accident Prevention Division.
Yeah, but that citation doesn't say that you have to carry weapons. The citation talks about unsafe working conditions.
But what the expanded letters of enforcement says is that if they've been put on notice under the expanded letters of enforcement that there is a hazardous condition existing in the workplace and the employer fails to correct it and someone is injured within a 36-month period from the date of the citation, then the agency or the employer can be held for repeat or willful violations, and I believe that's a minimum $10,000.
Right. My last question for you is, the amendment, the language I just suggested, really isn't going to be acceptable to you then because you want the clear green light, right?
I'm not sure that the amendment is going to do anything other than put us back into an argument with our employer.
Put you back in the position of making it makes it clear by statute that it's not unlawful for you to carry the weapon, then the question is whether or not your agency is going to authorize it. Well, you might want to think about it.
Let me think about that.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Bob Kaiser. Kaiser's no longer with us. Mr. Steve Bach. Thank you. Mr. Joe Spencer. Hey, Mr. Spencer, please say your name for the record and tell us what you have to say.
I'm Joe Spencer from the state in Oregon. I'm a jail visitor. I'm in no means by a skinhead. I just happened to discover that I can save money by clipping my own hair. So, Now, really, I believe that the people who work, from my experience at being a jail visitor, I got quite an education deliberately of my own choice by putting up bail for a prisoner. And had he stayed with me in my home for about 3 years, he was repeatedly arrested for the police. He was carrying concealed weapons. He was threatening and terrorizing women, held a knife to a woman's throat, was involved in kidnapping a woman, handcuffing her and tying her hand and foot to a bed. What does a guy have to do to be kept in a jail? That's what I ask you. And why doesn't a parole officer have a right to protect himself after he is trained? Why are these skinheads allowed to run wild up there in Portland? Let's send our governor back there to clean up the mess that he left. He said he cleaned up Portland, did a good job. Let's send the guy back there. I think it's time that we get tough. Let's look at the victim. How many women does a guy have to butcher before the law comes down on him? How many little kids have to be slaughtered? Let's get real. What is real? This morning, I knew I was coming down here to testify. I turned on television. I thought I'd get some news. A lot of screaming and yelling and shooting. What are our businessmen promoting? Let's take a look at what our businessmen are up to. Do they have a dollar and cents investment that they get out of this in some way? Let's get real. Let's give our police officers a break. I have the greatest respect for our police officers. I saw a young police officer come out and arrest this guy, but in the middle of the night, I never thought I'd hear a midnight knock on my door. But here they came and they arrested this guy. He'd been working for somebody. He lifted a $400 jeweled watch. They took him down, booked him, brought him back in a couple of hours. Because I'm single and rather nervy at times, well, I put up with this just to see how long this would go. But the guy's back in the correction institution? What the heck of a name is that for an outfit that turns these guys loose? The lawyers use these guys for their income. I and another guy, we have a joke about it. We see a big Continental or a Cadillac out there. Well, it looks like the lawyers are collecting on their meal check again. Now, we have to get realistic about this. I've been getting a set of cassette tapes from a police officer over in New Jersey. He says, America is too young to die, but it is dying. But we have to get realistic, get away from this politics deal, and face reality. I'd say let's send Vera Katz back to Portland right in this district and have her live there for a week. Maybe she'll change her ideas about some of these ideas about getting soft on crime. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Last person we have on this bill is Sheriff Bill Arnotto.
I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sheriff Bill Arnotto from Josephine County. I support this bill. I want to tell you, Josephine County is second in crime. I don't tell you that. I'm ashamed to tell you that, but I tell you that because I cannot protect the probation parole officer in Josephine County. I'm an administrator, but I'm a cop also. I know these probation officers. They are the right hand of the law enforcement officer. They're out there every night from midnight to 3 o'clock in the morning, side by side with a police officer. We owe it to protect their lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? Yes,
Sheriff, I appreciate appreciate the letters you've sent on a variety of issues. They are read and appreciated.
Thank you.
You're coming all the way up because I know it's a long trip.
Bill.
Oh, good. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2893, and we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3470. First person I have to call is Dr. Elliot Wiener. Weiner. Ready, then we'll... All righty. I'll call John McCauley of the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Mr. McCauley's also not here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, we were contemplating just going down to session and trying to come back and complete our public hearing after the conclusion of session. And I would just kind of like to run that by the committee and see if they think that's appropriate. And if so, we'll operate that way, or we can ask to be excused also.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Clark.
There are at least two bills on the floor session that I'm interested in, one of which I plan on speaking to.
Any objection to shutting it down, letting everybody go down and watch a floor session, a meeting back here 10 minutes after the conclusion of floor session for a further hearing on 3470? Good. So be it. We're in recess.
The public hearing, because I know a lot of folks have come from a long ways away to testify, and by both House and committee rules, any member or any number of our committee can hear public testimony. I do think we'll have our other members join us. There are several meetings going on right now. I can assure you people are not on their way home. They're in other meetings. So we will go ahead and reopen the hearing on House Bill 3470 and take public testimony. It looks to me like the first person signed up today is Bob Petrovsky. Okay. Bob Petrovsky.
The other thing you want to comment is testimony.
I have a handout for you.
Yes. Okay, one other thing. Because the hour is late, because we have two pages of witnesses here, I hate to do this, but we're gonna. This is 5 minutes. Okay, we'll go with about 3 to 4 minutes per person, and I don't want to be arbitrary about it, but if you could try and be concise.
Mr. Chairman and respected committee members, my name is Bob Petrovsky, and I'm here today as representative to the West Coast Arms Collectors Association and Western States Arms Collectors Association, which combined represent over 1,100 Oregon members. We as a group oppose House Bill 3410. We believe that there is no easy answer to the rising crime issue or preventing such tragedies as Patrick Purdy incident. However, we strongly believe that gun control laws, such as House Bill 3410, will do nothing, and I emphasize nothing, to prevent such tragedies or deter the criminal from the misuse of firearms, only deterring law-abiding citizens their right to keep and bear arms. All the laws on the books do absolutely no good unless those laws are enforced, which should be the issue of this assembly, not creating more laws. Laws do not stop the criminal or the mentally deranged from abusing our system or society. So why make more laws that will only affect the law-abiding citizen? Don't use the revolving doors of justice to further infringe upon my rights and the rights of others. We do not want to continue to be the victims to those that care nothing about such laws as House Bill 3410. It's time to make the system work for those that support it and stop making excuses as to why it doesn't work. The proponents of this bill, which by attendance at the last hearing on April 21st, and also today, they seem so few. And at the same time, they praise House Bill 3410 for its merits, which I have yet to see. Their proponents boast that the bill will make the issuances of concealed weapons permits mandatory, yet Section 7, Subsection 7, clearly states that a sheriff may deny a license if, in the sheriff's judgment, the applicant would be a danger to himself or others or to the community at large as a result of the applicant's mental or psychological state, past pattern of behavior, or participation in incidents involving violence or threats of violence. It does not take an attorney to see that this section clearly shows that the issuance of concealed weapons permits is not mandatory, but discretionary by the sheriff, which is basically what we have today. But yes, we can appeal the decision,
if we can afford the costs involved in having the appeal heard in circuit court. The bill does not provide for the destruction of the record of sales forms which are submitted to the state, either for the purchase or sale of a firearm. So essentially, this bill does create a registration process of all firearms in the state and where they are at. Do you think that the criminal will let you know where his firearms are at? As to the stiffer laws, the bill proposes that unlawful possession of a firearm is a Class A misdemeanor under Section 13. That is its present classification as well. Yet under Section 23, a person is guilty, and I quote, of a Class B felony for not following the provisions of the transfers of this bill. I would think it more serious to be in unlawful possession of a firearm than not to fill out the correct forms. Last week, we heard testimony from the proponents that they had polled their membership and found that they endorsed the bill. I offer for your examination copies of a petition opposing House Bill 347. This petition was displayed last Saturday in the town of Prineville, a small town in eastern Oregon with a population of approximately 5,000 people. You'll find that this petition has over 500 signatures in opposition to the bill. I believe this to be a truer indicator as to the feelings of the people of Oregon. In conclusion, it is our belief that the state does not need nor want further laws prohibiting their constitutional right to keep and bear arms, and urge you to consider this matter carefully with your constituents and oppose this needless legislation. If I can answer any questions, I'd be more than happy to.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
I have a
Representative Minnis.
Of the people betray their constituent, constituents. There is then no recourse left but in the exertion of that original right of self-defense, which is paramount to all positive forms of government, which, against the usurpations of the national leaders, may be exerted with infinitely better prospect of success. Over 100 years ago, Supreme Court Justice Story said, if the people frame a constitution, then the rulers must obey it. Neither ruler nor functionaries have the right to cripple or destroy it because, according to their view, it is inconvenient or unwise. Now I have just a couple of questions about the bill itself.
Okay, we don't answer questions, and
I want to say
we've had a couple things come to my attention. The other committee members are going to have to leave soon, so I want to try to people's testimony heard also.
Just
I want to say I agree with you that the guns and the biggest portion for a reason for them being in the Constitution is a means of redress of government.
It would seem
anybody on this committee would quarrel with that, but please summarize as briefly as possible so we can get on to everybody else too.
Section 21, Class B misdemeanor, ORS 166-240. I'll read it. Concealed, the misspelling, slung shot. It says in your bill, the new bill. I mean the revised bill. If a kid has a slingshot, I'm sure it means that in the back pocket. Now I'm making this statement. Covered by a shirt, would this be a concealed weapon? This is under concealed weapon, Class B misdemeanor. Would this be a concealed weapon? That's in the bill. Then my concluding statement is this: we should, as citizens of Oregon, work together and help Vera Katz avoid being a law violator because, gentlemen, in my opinion, as a voter and a private citizen, this is a clear violation of the Second Amendment. Any hindering of firearm ownership to the citizen, the peaceful citizen. Now, how many people in your district do you consider peaceful?
Probably not more than a handful. But
I thought you might consider the ones that elected you. All right, one more question.
Those were the peaceful ones. Yeah, the ones that voted against me.
You don't know Representative Calhoun.
All right. Now, one more. Will the vote, when the voting time comes, will it be a voice vote or a recorded vote? And I want to make sure that it's a recorded vote
on
when
this,
you come time
committee?
To vote.
Yeah, there's the tape recorder's on right now.
Yeah. I'm getting at is when it comes time to vote on this bill.
The FBI often comes to us and asks for copies of the tapes after
Okay, well, I need
I'm just kidding with you.
Mr. Chair.
Which will it be?
Every one of us will be on the record, both verbally and on tape.
On tape. You can identify.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I believe that's it. I thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
You. Mr.
I have a question.
Mr. Clark, please.
Who is Pastor Pete Peters?
Pastor Pete Peters is pastor of La Porte Church of Christ in Colorado. And you could write to him. This book is very, very well written. I just got it in the mail. I got one last week, and then it came in the mail today mailing.
I just have to say for the record that I don't think it's well written. I agree with lots of the constitutional law and lots of the government that's in there. I disagree with lots of the theology that's in there, and I just have to state that on the record.
You take exceptions to theology? Everything you wanted to know and preachers were afraid to tell you about gun control by Pastor Pete Peters.
Right.
That's the name of the book.
I might say that's a heck of a name for a pastor, too. I appreciate your testimony.
Okay.
Already.
Thank you.
What we're going to try to do is something we did before, because I don't want to be the only one sitting here. I want these other people to hear what you have to say, too. And if anybody wants to run long and they just want to talk at me, I'll stay a little late so I can hear everybody else when these two gentlemen
are
gone.
One other thing I do want to just say for the record, so that folks who are here know, all the written testimony comes into the record. I read it all. The rest of it gets recorded, and we get transcripts. So it's. I know that Representative Miller is in another committee meeting, and I know that Representative Mannix is right now too. And I just don't want the witnesses to think that people are just wandering off. They're in other committee meetings. We do read the stuff that you bring to us, and we review the material that you bring as well. So
it is all part of the official record. One thing, too, I did this last time before we call our next witness. When you read these bills, some of the things the gentleman before us was referring to is already in current law. And you probably could argue that a lot of the current law violates the Second Amendment, and I'm sure attorneys have done that, and they will in the future. But the parts that are in the bold print, that's the new stuff. The parts that are italicized in brackets, the funny-looking stuff, that's being taken out. And the normal print is the current law. So when you read this, just remember that, so you can figure out whether it's a change or something that's already in there anyway. All right, let's get on to the next witness here. What we're going to try to do is a little trick, just so we get on to everybody while we still have some people here, so you don't just have to talk at me and get my blank stare. We have three people here in a row that are all against this. And we'll get them up here together and give each of you 2 minutes, and then we'll try to go on to some questions. And if you have to run a little bit over, that's all right, but we'll try to get everybody in that we can. And I'm going to be here to hear everybody. Dan Doherty III will be one. Walt Husey. I think he's come all the way from John Day. And then we have Mike Percival. I think all three of these gentlemen are against this.
I'll go ahead and start. My name is Dan Doherty. I'm from Lake Oswego. Had this bill been law when Patrick Purdy was in Oregon, I would now be serving a 5-year sentence in prison. He would not. This bill is fatally flawed in several sections. The one that bothers me probably the most and that we'll probably all spend the most prison time on is Section 24. That's on page 18. It states any person who changes, alters, removes, or obliterates the identification number of any firearm shall be punished upon conviction by imprisonment in the custody of the Department of Corrections for not more than 5 years. Possession of any such firearm upon which the same has been changed, altered, removed, or obliterated is presumptive evidence that the possessor has changed, altered, removed, or obliterated the same. Well, that takes into everything. You have an old rifle where you've got arrested serial number or something on there that's no longer there, that person has now committed a crime.
Mr.
It's presumptive evidence that...
Mr. Doherty, I think that's current law.
It's current law, but this also gives a lot more teeth, gives the state police money to carry out, you know, searching for these violations, and it lets them write more administrative rules, et cetera, on this kind of stuff. There's implementation of this, which has not been there in the past. But this brings into, there's target pistols that you change slides on, that you change different frames on. You have numbered parts on Lugers, for instance, that don't match up. You might have a numbered slide on a gun that will have the serial number, and then you'll have a different serial number on the barrel or on the pistol grip. And what happens...
If I can comment quickly, it looks to me like the old language says a person that alters, et cetera, the name of the maker, model, manufacturer's number, or other mark or identification on any pistol or revolver. The new language just says the identification number of any firearm. So if that's that being the case, it would seem that we're instead of saying a number of things can't be obliterating, we're saying only one.
Right, but it's being enforced at this point. It's being enforced whenever a gun is sold or any transaction. They're going to be looking for those things.
Well, anyway, if my reading of the law is correct, we're reducing the number of things that are going to be criminal as opposed to increasing them in this section.
Right, but where they weren't looking for those things before, those will now be looked for, and those can be...
You might actually have to
chuck
now if you commit a crime, you might actually go to jail for it.
Well,
appreciate your testimony.
What they're calling a crime, but
okay.
Here's another example. If you have, say, an 18-year-old son and he's going to go off to college, he might be a target shooter. You give him, say, a Hammerly target pistol to take to college to shoot. Well, you've committed a crime right there by giving him that pistol because you're no longer. It's not temporary because he's no longer with you. You're not observing the kid as he's shooting. So he's hauled that off to college. He's gotten his gun box and, say, a hatchback automobile. It doesn't have a trunk that's separate from the rest of the automobile. He can get to that gun box. So he, therefore, has a concealed weapon in that pistol box. But, again, it's not something that's enforced. I mean, this...
I've worked with the prosecutor and public defender both, and those laws are enforced.
Where an 18-year-old can't take a handgun to...
Well, the concealed weapon law, if you have a vehicle underneath your seat in your automobile or in your glove compartment or inside some kind of a package so it's hidden, those laws are definitely enforced.
Right, but this is an 18-year-old that cannot apply for this concealed weapons permit like a 21-year-old person could do so. I could go ahead and apply for that and carry that gun legally wherever I was going to take it, in its gun box, wherever, right next to me if I got the concealed weapons permit.
Your quarrel is with not the concealed weapon law as it currently exists, but with the age.
With the age is one of the factors in here. So he's taken this down to college. You've committed another crime by giving him that gun, and you've added to a commission of a felony because he's carrying that gun in his car, which is illegal. Now he's going to shoot that on OSU property down there on the OSU Pistol Club. Well, he's an 18-year-old, not a 21-year-old, and he doesn't have a right to have that on public property. As you have to have, if you have a concealed weapons permit, you can have that gun on public property. He's down at Oregon State University. He's committed a felony right there. And my time's adding up here because I added to the commission that felony by giving him the gun in the first place. So I'm looking at the death sentence here already. And that's just one example. Another problem I have is with Section 21 of this bill on page 17. It's talking about knives, switchblade knives, etc., or any similar type of device that can cause harm. This is a lock blade pocket knife. I carry this all the time. It's a common item. It's probably a preferred pocket knife, but it can open quicker than a switchblade. So
I think what the committee counsel is telling me is that that's the current law. There's no change in that law.
I know, but what I'm getting at, the whole point of this is that there's now money for them to go out and look for these kinds of things. There's the ability to write administrative rules as to how they go about doing that.
I think that the money that we're talking about, there's money for a study, which is backed very strongly by the National Rifle Association, because they want to prove that most citizens that go in to buy a gun are not Patrick Purdy. And it's also backed by the, I think, by the anti-gun people, because they want to find out how many of those people are Patrick Purdy. And that's where the money in this bill is going to, is to that study. And then there's also money going for the more extensive background checks for the concealed weapon permits. And I don't necessarily support the spending of that money, but I just in terms of knowing what we're looking at, that's where the money goes. This money's not going towards additional enforcement. We're going to do plenty of that probably later on in the session with some ways and means bills, but that's not going to happen in this.
Okay, well then you can use items such as this or the gun that doesn't have the right matching serial numbers to prevent somebody from getting the concealed weapons permit. There's all kinds of different ways that this can be used, and I expect that they will be used for that purpose.
Okay. You know, in Lake Oswego, now that's in Clackamas County?
The part I'm in is Multnomah.
Okay, there's only about 10. You don't have a concealed weapon permit, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay, there's only about 10 in Multnomah County. I think Dick Bogle has half of them. Okay. So one of the things this bill is intended to do is to help gun owners in Multnomah, in Clackamas, in Washington County to obtain concealed weapon permits when currently they're not able to get them.
It's left at the discretion of the sheriff, and these are the same sheriffs that are still in those counties that still have the ability at their discretion, if they feel that I am a threat to myself or others, to deny that permit.
Right.
So it really doesn't make it any easier. He can still, I don't see that these guys are going to all of a sudden turn around.
Just for education process, the big perk of this bill for gun people, and I consider myself a strong gun person, the big perk in this bill is that people in the Portland area particularly are going to be able to obtain a concealed weapon permit, and if they're denied, they're going to have an appeals process where the judge can say, you have to give this person a permit, whereas right now you can't get one. And that's the biggest reason that the National Rifle Association is in support of this bill as a package. Does that make sense?
But we're giving away too much to do that. I mean, I don't want to be fingerprinted. I don't want to be thumbprinted. I don't want to be photographed. Assumably, they would do that in the same area where they photograph criminals, and I might even have to hold up something. I don't know. I don't want any of that to have to occur, and I don't think I'd go for that concealed weapons permit to do that.
You might want to read the upcoming federal legislation, but that's going to be required anyway. That's
if it goes through.
It's already passed.
November 88.
It will be in effect. It was passed in November of
88. Mr. Chair,
appreciate your testimony. Yes, Richard
Clark.
Can I
just suggest that we need to move this along? There are lots of people to testify.
Can I say something?
Time is short, and I do. I mean, we're listening to the testimony. We're taking that in, and we're. I'm afraid what we're going to do is end up giving.
We're going to end up cutting people off.
Cutting people off is afraid what we're doing.
What Representative Clark's concern is we're going to cut people off if we spend too much time on certain people, and I've been trying to educate them a little bit on some of the major issues so that we can address those. But if you have any quick closing comments, let's get on to those, and we'll get on to the other.
Very quickly, Representative Minnis was speaking that the Oregon State Police, it's unlawful for them to keep those records, but I couldn't find any penalties in there if they did. And I couldn't find anything that prevent them from giving that information to the Department of Motor Vehicles or any other state or federal agency, and that agency keeping that information. There's virtually nothing in here that puts any penalty on them for keeping that information themselves or passing it on.
There will be.
It's been noted.
Yeah. There will be.
Thank you very much. We're looking strongly at that. Appreciate your testimony. Please
Mr.
state
Chairman
your name
and representatives,
tell us what
my
you
name
have to
is
say.
Walt Hussey. I'm from John Day over in the state of Eastern Oregon. And I oppose this bill for some of the following reasons. First of all, I think the whole principle of it and a lot of the existing legislation is a violation of the Second Amendment, both in spirit and of the letter of the Second Amendment, because any infringement, period, falls under the same category, whatever the intentions are. Statistics say that 99% of the lawfully purchased firearms and pistols are not used in crimes. So that leaves 1% or less, according to some statistics, that is used from lawful purchase. And I think the whole premise of these bills, this bill and some of the other bills that are pending is going about it the wrong way. It's going after the ones that are innocent to try and get at the ones that are guilty. And it penalizes and makes law-abiding citizens have to jump through more bureaucratic hoops to try and achieve something that they have a God-given right to have. And they can waive that anytime they want or lose it if they violate somebody else's rights. And I think that's the principle of the Second Amendment and of the whole Bill of Rights as a protection. And I think the whole premise of law and justice is that you're innocent until proven guilty. And the whole permit situation treats you as if you're guilty until you're proved innocent. And people that, I mean, commit the crimes with these guns, they don't go through these hoops. So it just doesn't make sense. And I fail to see anything else but as a vehicle of taxing and registration of firearms and of people who have firearms. And it just doesn't make any sense going about it this way. And I think it also violates in some parts the Fourth Amendment or Article 4 of the Bill of Rights, being secure in your person's place and effects, having to go through fingerprints or thumbprints, whatever, and photographs, and just being presumed guilty until you're innocent, and even being susceptible to arrest for having something like a concealed weapon. And I myself, I don't carry a concealed weapon, but I think if this bill were to pass, I would, just despite it, would carry a concealed weapon without going through the necessary hoops, regardless of what the consequences are. But it will make criminals out of people that are innocent. And it just doesn't make sense.
Thank you much. I appreciate your testimony. Under current law, there's a crime of carrying a concealed weapon without a permit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to spite the law, you can go carry a concealed weapon today and go to jail just like you will under
That's
this
right.
law. So
for a matter of principle.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
I just want to say how much I appreciate you coming all the way over from John Day. I mean, I know
well,
it's not an easy trip.
There's a lot of people that would have liked to have come over, too, but they couldn't afford it, or we didn't get much notice on this. So
I know that.
You
appreciate
just made
comments.
The point.
Appreciate you, too. I come from the great state of Medford. So.
Thanks.
Okay, is there a Mike Percival that was here? Well, what we'll do is after we get done with everybody else, I'll come back to you and you can come talk to me some more, okay? Hey, Mike Percival's not here. Is there a Bill Schillig? Hey, Bill's here. Let's try to get, also try to get Dave Traylor here, if he's here. And Joe Spencer. Joe Spinner. Look on Joe. How about Dave Simmons?
I'm here.
He's for and against the bill, so I like somebody like that. Okay. Just please start from the right here and state your name and tell us what you have to say.
My name is Bill Schillig, Mr. Chairman, and what's left of the committee, and Ms. Robinson. I think you have my handout with my business card on it. Before I get on my soapbox, there were some things that you had questions about last Friday and today. One of them was instructing in the use of firearms, and some question was asked about hunter safety programs. I was a hunter safety instructor in the state of California, also a gun dealer in California and in Oregon. And Representative Mannix and Representative Miller kept asking, how do we identify a felon? If you're a gun dealer, you never identify a felon because a felon never comes in and buys a gun from you. Felons buy guns on the streets. They have sisters, brothers, wives, friends buy guns for them. They don't buy guns. And in all my years of selling guns and buying guns, a felon has never come up and bought a gun. They know better. They know they're not going to get it. In the state of California is the third thing. The process is a quintuplicate process to buy a gun in the state of California, a handgun. Everything goes on that. The name of the gun, the serial number of the gun, the type of the gun, your name, birth date, California driver's license, and I think Social Security number, which is used throughout the state of California for insurance information, car insurance, life insurance, everything else. And if you fail in one place, it's spit out someplace by the same computer elsewhere. You can't beat it. So I think that ought to be a part of your bill, mandatory, even though it's against the law. Everything else in the bill hurts the gun owner. I am against the gun bill as you have it. But if the gun bill goes through, I would like to see those three items that I've outlined on my sheet of paper. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. This gentleman in the center.
I'm Dave Traylor from John Day. It was a long drive over, a longer wait, and I'm afraid a longer drive home yet tonight. I'd like to state that I'm against this. There's so many different gun laws on the books right now, it's just totally confusing throughout this country, let alone here in Oregon. And if we ignore history, we're kind of doomed to repeat it. California, in the last 63 years, has went from a 1 to a 3, a 5, and a 15-day waiting period, and it hasn't done any good. Washington, D.C. has the most restrictive gun laws in the country. They've had over 200 murders there so far this year, and it doesn't seem to slow anything down. The Sullivan Law in New York City has been in effect since the turn of the century. It's extremely restrictive, and it hasn't done anything to slow down crime. Firearms are basically legally used by the majority of people in this country, and it's just another restriction on us to do that. The concealed weapon permit statewide is a good idea if they could have not tacked on all this other stuff that went with it. I have a concealed weapons permit in Grant County for probably the last 15 years. It's $5 to get it. It's an annual renewal fee, and it does have some problems there with the, you know, with the sheriff. There's political aspects and personal things that can be brought into it as to whether or not you're issued a permit, and I see problems with that. But basically, we need to go after the criminal element, the people that misuse firearms, make it prohibitive for them to want to do repeat crimes, and the citizens that are the backbone of this state and of the country, just leave them alone. Thank you.
To your testimony. You, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Simmons, and I'm here on behalf of myself and the 100 or so members of the Chehalem Valley Sportsmen's Club, most of whom are also members of the National Rifle Association and or the Oregon State Rifle and Pistol Association. House Bill 3470 represents a commendable effort to resolve many conflicting demands, and it contains many good provisions which should be retained and enacted into law. However, the fingerprinting and increased record-keeping provisions of this bill would expand the misguided policy of attempting to screen out criminals and mental defectives when they try to purchase a firearm.
Excuse me, if we could, we'll try to read the testimony here, if you could kind of highlight it for us.
I am.
Okay.
There's a lot more in there than I'm going to read. I'd like to know why we are waiting until then to screen them out. If someone is too dangerous to be trusted with a firearm, why are they even allowed to remain at large in society? Are we then expected to trust them with a knife or a hammer or any other form of weapon, or even with an automobile for that matter? I noticed earlier today, I was appalled at the large number of felons that are being allowed to live among us, with a small number of parole officers apparently risking their lives daily to try and keep tabs on these people. What the screening of gun purchasers really does is to restrict the rights of ordinary citizens in order to permit dangerous criminals and mental defectives to live among us. I find it hard to believe that that is what our elected officials really want to do to their constituents. Moreover, the mere collection of information which can be used to establish gun registration is in and of itself dangerous to the well-being of a free society. It is to the credit of the people who drafted this bill that it attempts to address that issue. And some people have pointed out that the provisions are not entirely adequate. It's my understanding that it's already a violation of Oregon state law to maintain files based on gun purchase records, and it's also my understanding that a number of municipalities are already in violation of that law. Are we really expected to believe that any further restrictions will be enforced any more effectively? The federal government is apparently considering using electronic fingerprint scanners in order to attempt point-of-purchase screening of gun buyers on a nationwide basis. Apparently, some of those drafting this bill feel that enacting similar legislation at the state level will be unimportant because the feds are going to do it anyway. As far as I know, the McCollum Amendment recommends that a study be done to determine a correct approach. It does not mandate that whatever is determined will be put in place, and our state legislators will find themselves in a rather awkward position if the federal legislation does not materialize. I'd like to suggest to the committee that they eliminate the fingerprinting and increased record-keeping portions of the bill and substitute some real anti-crime provisions, such as the limitation or elimination of plea bargaining and parole, particularly for violent crimes and repeat offenders. Rather than going on record in support of wholesale fingerprinting of gun owners, let's send a message to the rest of the country that Oregon at least doesn't turn habitual criminals loose to purchase firearms in the first place. Thank you very much.
Testimony. I have just kind of a quick question.
Sure.
I had to rate this thing 50 good, 50 bad on a scale of 1 to 100. How much was good and how much was bad? About what kind of numbers would you give me? Because this is it's a compromise bill meant to have some bad things and some good things in it. What would you rate it? 60% good and 40 bad, or vice versa, or how would you rate this?
Well, I don't know if I can answer your question directly, but I can tell you what I got from talking to the members of my gun club. The people who hold concealed weapons permits and are really interested in concealed weapons permits are generally, who are a smaller number, are generally willing to accept the compromise as it is. The rest of the club would never accept this bill with the fingerprinting provision in it, if that gives you any indication.
National Rifle Association wants the fingerprinting for the non-handguns with the sunset on it, which is expected to wind up running into the federal law anyway, but they want the fingerprinting for the study that's going to show that people that buy guns are not Patrick Purdy.
I understand why they want the fingerprinting, but I have considerable expertise in computer systems, and I think the people who are asking for these things are naive, including the National Rifle Association.
Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Clark.
I'm going to apologize to the remaining witnesses. I do have to leave. just say I appreciate people coming from as far away as John Day. Representative Dominey has agreed to help us out by sitting for a while as an ex officio member, and he and I stay in close contact, and I do regret that I have to leave, but I do.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Clark's going to go fight for truth, justice, and the American way, so we'll carry on without him. We have a some more people against the bill. We have Charlie Mills and Dean Smith and William Warder. Ortner?
Warther.
And he's for and against the bill. Mr. Mills, please.
Yeah, I'm Charlie Mills, a member of the Albany Rifle and Pistol Club, Oregon IPSC, which is a state organization of the World Organization International Practical Shooters Confederation, USPSA, which is the United States chapter, the World IPSC body itself, and the NRA. I'm a competitive handgun shooter. I shoot probably between 20 and 30,000 rounds a year. I've shot guns ever since I was, 8, 9 years old. I've never shot anybody. I've never shot at anybody. Never committed any crimes with any guns. And I don't feel